Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this audio chapter 33 of Exodus, verses 1 through 23. I'm going to call it Moses and Yahweh at the first tent of meeting. Our context is this. Moses has already come down from the mountain after receiving all the detailed instructions on how to build the tabernacle. He sees the children of Israel in gross idolatry, where they are sporting about in idolatrous revelry. They've made a golden calf. He's very upset, of course. And so now we see Moses here in chapter 33 meeting with Yahweh at the first tent of meeting. Now, not the tabernacle, but this is a separate tent of meeting. So we start now in Exodus 33, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'To your descendants I will give it.' I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey." That all sounds very good, but here's the bad news. Yahweh continues, "For I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way." When was God speaking to Moses here? This is before the tent of meeting was set up, assuming the verses are in chronological order. The tent of meeting was set up in verse 7. We're in verse 1. The commentator Ellicott says it is at the base of Mount Sinai that God is speaking to Moses. Moses has come down from the mountain, and he's seen all the people worshiping the golden calf. And so God says, "You know, y'all get out of here. I'm going to send an angel in front of you, but I ain't going with you anymore. I'm not going to go up in your midst." Why did God say go up from here? Well, because Sinai is geographically lower than Canaan. Canaan is higher geographically. Now, who's this angel that God promises to send before the Israelites? Well, could be Jesus, or it could be a created angel. I tend to think it's a created angel, although usually when you see angels in the Old Testament, I always think it's probably going to be Jesus. But here, God has said, "I'm not going up with you. I'm going to send my angel." So if it's Jesus going before him, well, Jesus is God. But God says, I'm not going to go up in your midst. So he would be saying, I'm not going to go up in your midst, but I'm going to have Jesus leading the way. Well, that doesn't sound like much punishment. A created angel, though, well, okay, you're going to go up on your own. I'll send a created angel. We'll see what he can do. I think that sounds more like it. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that, quote, "I will not go up." When God says that, it sounds like Jesus isn't going to go with them. So he agrees with that view, and I do too. Now, this angel who was promised to go before might be the same angel that was mentioned in Exodus 23:20. When God says, "Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I prepare." That's the angel of the covenant, he's called, and is presumed to be Jesus, as John Gill and Adam Clark say. Well, if it's the same angel as Exodus 23:20, then the angel that God's going to send before them is Jesus. But like I just said, I don't think that's really who it is. I think this is another angel. I could be wrong. Now, God mentions all the Canaanites that are going to be driven out by the Israelites as they go up into the promised land. Now, the interesting thing about this list of Canaanites is that there are many lists of Canaanite nations in the Old Testament. Some mention two Canaanite tribes, one list. Another list mentions five, another six, another seven, another 10, another 12 Canaanite tribes. Here's the one that says there's going to be two Canaanite tribes, Genesis 13:7. "Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling in the land." Now here's five mentioned, five Canaanite tribes mentioned, Numbers 13:29. "Amalek is living in the land of the Negev," and starting right here, "the Hittites, number one, the Jebusites, number two, the Amorites, number three, and the Canaanites, number four," and I guess I should have counted Amalek as number one, that makes five. Six Canaanite tribes are mentioned in Exodus 3:8. And remember, Canaanites, Canaan is a term for the whole land of Israel, and Canaan is also refers to a Canaan tribe proper, one particular tribe. The use of the term is ambiguous. Judges 3:5, there's six Canaanite tribes mentioned here: the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, the classic description is of seven, because seven is the number of completeness. This is according to the NIV Study Bible. This is listed in Deuteronomy 7:1, where we see the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, in Genesis 15, we see 10 tribes, the Kenite, and the Kenizzite, and the Kadmonite. Those are added to others, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Rephaim, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. And 12 were mentioned in Genesis 10, verses 15 through 18. We've got Canaan. We've got Heth. That's the Hittites. We have the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, and the Sinites, and the Arvadites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. So, I've decided that when it comes to the list of ites, that I only need to know a few. One is the Hittites. That's the famous empire, because that's a whole empire that's stretched between 1680 B.C. and 1178 B.C., those dates according to Wikipedia. It's a huge, famous ancient empire, which centered on Anatolia, present-day Turkey, and some of the successor Hittite kingdoms that broke up from there kind of inched their way over into Syria, down into the Promised Land. Remember Uriah the Hittite, who was somewhat after the Hittite Empire. So the Hittites are kind of important. We need to remember those. The Jebusites are not all that important, but they were the ones that controlled Jerusalem, that David wiped out to get Jerusalem. So they're kind of easy to remember. And then the Amorites, they're famous because that's also a generic name for all the pagan tribes back then. They were kind of a ruddy-skinned, light-skinned, red hair kind of people. We learned these from the Egyptian monuments. They had a different name. The Amari, I think, is what they were called in the ancient Near East. And they spread all around present-day Lebanon, present-day Israel, all the way over into Syria, maybe into southern Turkey. So they were a big, big, big tribe. The Rephaim are famous because they're the people of that are giants. They're mentioned a lot. We'll mention them as we go through. And other than that, I don't see the point of remembering where the Hivites were, the Perizzites were, because half the time the scholars don't know where they were. But at any rate, they're all going to get wiped out, God says. Now, in verse 3, he says he's not going to go with them. He had earlier made a promise of protection, but that promise of protection has now been withdrawn. We see that earlier promise of protection in Exodus 23:21. Be on your guard before him and obey his, that means God's angels, obey the angel's voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. And so God has already promised to be with them, sending that angel, who I'm assuming is Jesus, before them. But now he's pulling his promise back because of their sin. He doesn't completely pull his promise back because he says, I'm not going to be in your midst. I'm not going to be with you internally, but I will help you externally with this angel that's supposed to go before you. Now, I presume this is why the Israelites wandered for 40 years in the wilderness, because of their rebellious idolatry. The application for this is that rebellion against God really screws up people's lives. Even though they eventually made it to the Promised Land, their lives were screwed up 40 years, and they all died unless they were under 20 years old. They all died in the wilderness. Folks, rebellion against God has momentous consequences in the individual Christian's life or individual human being's life. It is a dumb career move to rebel against God. Really, really stupid. 9 verse 3. God says, I'm not going to go amongst you because I might destroy you. In other words, if I were traveling amongst you, you are likely to sin, and that's going to force me to destroy you. In verse 5, God repeats, tells Moses what to say to Israel, and this is what Moses is supposed to say. You are an obstinate people. Obstinate people. Should I go up in your midst for one moment, I would destroy you. So that's a little bit more forceful there. It's not a maybe, a condition. It might happen. Oh, no. 1 minute with you guys, I'm going to destroy you because you are so sinful. All right, let's read verses 4 through 6. When the people heard this sad word, the sad word being that God would no longer be with them on the journey, the people went into mourning, and none of them put on his armaments, For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the sons of Israel, you are an obstinate people. Should I go up in your midst for one moment? I would destroy you. Now, therefore, put off your ornaments from you, that I may know what I shall do with you. So that's why they were sad. Moses had relayed Yahweh's unpleasant words, and they're sad. Verse 6, so the sons of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. All right, so no more jewelry from Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. Mount Horeb's another name for Mount Sinai. It might be two different peaks of the same mountain range. Nobody knows. But from Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai all the way up into the Promised Land, no jewelry. Why? Because jewelry is a sign of happiness and everything's okay, but everything wasn't okay. It was a sign of mourning, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill puts it. They were mourning because of their sin. Adam Clark says that the Septuagint adds that the upper, which is the more beautiful garments, were stripped also, and they didn't wear their upper garments. Now, Moses is relaying God's words to the people in verse 5, and God says, "Strip off, put off your ornaments, that I may know what I shall do with you." Well, I mean, this is obviously spoken in the matter of men, anthropomorphically, because obviously God knew what he was going to do. But what he is saying is, take off your garments and let's let you wait so you'll see what I'm going to do with you. We'll see. Now, of course, God knows, but the people don't know. Exodus 33, verses 7 through 11. Now, Moses used to take the tent. The Holman Christian Study Bible has a tent. Let's read it that way. Now, Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who saw the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And it came about, whenever Moses went out to the tent, that all the people would rise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent of meeting. Whenever Moses entered the tent of meeting, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. When all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would arise and worship, each at the entrance of his tent. Then the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. So this is the famous tent of meeting. Now, the first thing we need to remember is that the tabernacle was also called the tent of meeting. The tabernacle has not been built yet. The instructions have been given, but it has not been created, actually built yet. And so this tent of meeting is a different tent of meeting. And notice it's a good distance from the camp. The tabernacle was right in the center of the camp. Why was the tent of meeting this first? I'm going to call it the first tent of meeting. Why was it a good distance from the camp? Because God didn't want to be in the camp anymore. He's already said, "I'm not going to be in the midst of you. I'm going to send an angel in front of you." He didn't want to be there because they sinned horribly against him. And it was a good distance from the camp. It was a good way. But Moses had not given up on God. God had not given up on Moses, and they would go out and have discussions out there. When Moses would enter this tent of meeting, verse 9, the pillar of cloud would descend. That pillar of cloud, of course, is the Shekinah glory of God, where God was, and as a visible means of, so the people could picture God, he would stand there in a pillar of cloud. At the entrance of the tent, the Lord would speak with Moses. I assume that's audibly. It's no other way to get all these precise instructions except audible voices. That's real easy for a supernatural God to do. And this was such a sign. Moses needed this picture, if you will, of him standing before the pillar of cloud. He needed the affirmation from God because the people now were scared to death. They'd been caught in their idolatry, and the people would rebel against Moses at the drop of a hat. I mean, now they're looking at God. Moses speaking to God face to face, that's going to give Moses some street cred. It's going to give Moses some credibility. And so the people would stand at their tents, look off into the distance at the tent of meeting, look at that tent of glory, probably see the little outline of Moses going in there. And so they're thinking, well, maybe Moses knows what he's talking about. After all, Moses is going into God to see God and talking to him face to face, just as a man speaks with his friend. The NIV Study Bible says that as the Old Testament mediator, Moses was unique among the prophets. Moses didn't have to search to understand what had been prophesied like the Old Testament prophets. We read in 1 Peter 1:10, concerning this salvation, that's the gospel, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that would come to you searched and carefully investigated. They're trying to figure out what the prophecy that they had just seen, what it meant. Not so with Moses. He just talked like two people would talk face to face. Moses was an incredible prophet. He was a lawgiver, but he was also a prophet. John Gill says about this face-to-face encounter, quote, "not by an angel, but he himself in person, but he, God, himself in person, was talking to Moses. Not by a dream or vision, but apparently in real visible appearance. Not in dark speeches, but clearly in plain words, easy to be understood. And not by voice from heaven at a distance, but mouth to mouth, being very near as when on the mount and now at the door of the tabernacle." Except it's the tent of meeting, it's not the tabernacle. That cloud that Moses was speaking to, that couldn't be faked. It proved to the people that Moses was talking to God. And that's why they stood up and worshiped at their tent doors in verse 10. Because they're saying, we are looking at a miracle. Now let's look at this mention of Joshua. Verse 11, Joshua is said to be young. His servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Well, first of all, why did he not leave the tent of meeting? Possibly his job was to guard the tent, as the NIV Study Bible says, and it says he would not depart. Does that mean he would never depart? I assume it means, this is just my thinking, that he did not depart when Moses was gone so he could guard the tent. That doesn't mean that he wouldn't take a break every now and then and leave. Now we have a small problem in verse 11. Joshua is said to be young. Here's some options to solve that. Two options. First option, Joshua was young relative to Moses. John Gill and Adam Clark say that absolutely, his absolute age, Joshua's age, was probably in his mid-50s, which is not all that young. Back then, people lived a lot longer. How do Gill and Clark get this age of Joshua in his mid-50s? They calculate from Joshua 24, verse 29. It came about after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years. And if you do calculate how long the wandering in the wilderness took, then add the years that Joshua had to slay Canaanites, you add it all up, and you get somewhere in the mid-50s is when Joshua was at this point. So, relative to Moses, he was young. And remember, he had already led an army against the Amalekites just a couple months earlier, right before they got to Mount Sinai. I say a couple months is just a short time. I'm not exactly sure how long it was, but it wasn't very long. If he was fighting in an army, he couldn't be all that old. He was young enough to be a general. That's one option. It's just a relative age. He's young relative to Moses. Option number two is that all servants are called young, according to Adam Clark. Well, I like option number one better. We go now to Exodus 33, verses 12 through 13. Then Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you yourself have not let me know whom you will send with me." Moses is looking for some human help. He did have the help of the angel that God had promised him, but he's talking about a human. I want somebody to help me with this job. Moses continues speaking to Yahweh, "Moreover, you have said, 'I have known you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight.' Now, therefore, I pray you," Moses says to God, "if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people." Now, before I go into the details of these two verses, I must say that Moses really had a lot of chutzpah here. He started out worrying that God's going to leave the people in the wilderness, or he's going to leave their midst. He's very upset about that, and his whole aim in talking to God is he's saying, "Please, God, don't do that." So, but even despite this, despite the fact that the people had sinned so much, he said, "God, I want to know you. I want to know you. If I found favor in your sight, let me know your ways that I may know you, that I may find favor in your sight." Moses here reminds me of Jacob wrestling with the angel at Penuel at the Jabbok River as he was coming back from Padan Aram, Syria. And he wrestled with that angel. That angel was Jesus. He said, "Give me a blessing, give me a blessing." Well, this is what Moses is doing here. He's wrestling with God, not physically, but verbally. "Give me a blessing, give me a blessing. I want to know you." Oh, think of the applications you could do with this verse if you were giving an exhortatory teaching somewhere. Do we want to know God the way that Moses wanted to know God? All right, we start back in verse 12. Moses says, "Look, you're saying bring up the people. That's fine, God, but I don't have anybody to help me, so who are you going to help me with?" He's saying, then as the NIV Study Bible puts out, he says, "Look, a mere angel that you promised, that's no substitute for you, God. I need somebody else." Now, in verse 12, Moses said, "Moreover, you have said, 'I have known you by name, and you have found favor in my sight.'" When did God tell Moses, "I know you by name"? Well, here's two instances. This comes from Ellicott, the commentator. At the burning bush, Exodus 3:4, when the Lord saw that Moses had gone over to look at the bush, God called out to him from the bush, "Moses, Moses, here I am." Knew him by name. God knew Moses by name and called him by his name, Moses. Which is pretty awesome if you think about it. I mean, you know, if God says, "Hey, Dan, ooh, I think I'd remember that." And so Moses refers back to that and says, "You have said I've known you by name because you called me Moses at the burning bush." And I assume the finding favor in God's sight that Moses is referring to, that Moses is referring to the fact that God had found favor, that Moses had found favor in God's sight. He was referring to the burning bush because just by the fact that God called Moses by his name showed that Moses had found favor in God's sight. Another example of where God knew Moses by name is in Exodus 24:16. This is right before Moses went up for 40 days and 40 nights to talk to God. Exodus 24:16, "The glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called Moses from the cloud, 'Moses, Moses, come on up here, call Moses by name.'" So Moses is referring to this. Moses says to God in verse 12, "Moreover, you, God, have said to me, Moses, this is what you said to me. I have known you, Moses, by name." Well, so Moses is accurately recounting what had happened in the past. And God has already told Moses, "You have found favor in my sight." That's because he called him by name. God called Moses by name. Now, based on the fact that I have found favor, Moses said in verse 13, "Now therefore I pray you, if I have found favor in your sight," and that if there means since, according to John Gill, "since I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways that I may know you." So, I mean, Moses has already had some great spiritual experiences seeing God face to face, or close to face to face. Burning bush, Shekinah glory cloud at the top of Mount Sinai. But he wanted to know God more than that. "Let me know your ways, that I may find favor in your sight." And you'd say, well, Moses has already found favor in your sight, in God's sight. Why is he asking for more favor? Well, I assume it's because Moses wanted more favor from God. He already had some. He wanted more. This is a great application. God might have blessed you like crazy in your life, but there's nothing wrong with asking for more blessings, because he loves to bless you. Now, he's not going to give out his blessings willy-nilly. He might say, well, we got to train you a little bit more. You know, you don't get the blessing of winning the race unless you train a little bit. But nonetheless, nothing wrong with asking God for blessings. I guess it's true. Christianity is a bless me religion. Of course, the people who get a hold of that truth that God blesses them, they also forget that God is also a God of discipline and a God who will lead you through the valley of the shadow of death. Although you mayn't fear no evil, you're still going to go through the valley of the shadow of death and the trials and all that. So people abuse this idea of Christianity being a bless me religion, but actually it is a bless me religion if you receive the blessings according to the constraints and the conditions that God puts on you as he doles out his blessings. Now in the last phrase of verse 13, Moses said to Yahweh, "Consider too that this nation is your people." That's his second argument. Let me summarize Moses' arguments to God here. He says, look, there's two things I want to point out to you, God. First of all, Israel is God's people, so please don't let them punish. Where did he say that? In the last part of verse 13. Consider too that this nation is your people, your people, your people. You going to let them go down? Of course, the implication of that would be that God would let his people go. People would look at the Israelites and laugh at Yahweh and so forth. He's already made that argument before. All right, well, that was the first part of his argument. Israel is God's people. The second part of his argument is, look, I found favor in your sight, so I need some help leading these people out. Can't you give that to me? More help than an angel? How had Moses found favor? Well, Moses had been made Israel's leader. Moses had worked incredible miracles through God, like the 10 plagues in Exodus. God had talked to Moses face to face at the burning bush and at the Shekinah glory cloud on Mount Sinai. So since God had already done that, God, why don't you just go ahead and get this job done and give me somebody to help me get these people out of the wilderness into the promised land? We go now to Exodus 33, verses 14 through 15. And he, Yahweh, said, "My presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest." So you see, all of Moses' begging of the Lord got God to change his mind. I'm speaking anthropomorphically, of course. God changed his mind at the behest of a praying saint. The applications of that should be obvious. "My presence shall go with you." Of course, originally, he said he would not go with the people. I said in verse 3, we've already said, "I'm not going to go with you. I'm going to send an angel." But now he says, "I'm not going to go in your midst." And now he says, "I am going to go with you." That means in the midst of the people. So application here, when things look bad because of sin, appeal to God's mercy. Nothing wrong with that. God loves you to go to him for help, mercy, forgiveness. God says, "I will give you rest." I don't know if that you is plural or singular, but I'm assuming it means Moses and the children of Israel, they'll get rest. What does that mean? Well, a couple of options. Option number one, John Gill suggests, God's going to give Moses and the people peace of mind on the way. Rest. John Gill favors the optional answer number two is that this rest is the promised land. I will give you the promised land. The promised land is called, yes, rest. Actually, it is. Hebrews 4:1. "Therefore, since the promise to enter his rest remains, let us beware that none of you be found to have fallen short." And if you read the rest of the chapter of Hebrews 4, it's obvious the rest is talking about entering into the promised land. So I'm going to assume that's right. I will give you rest. I'll give you rest in the promised land. Verse 15. "Then he," Moses, "said to him," God said to God, "if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here." So Moses, what he's saying is, I just soon not be the leader of Israel anymore if your presence is not going to be with me. I just as soon stay here and die in the wilderness. I'm not going to do this unless you're with me. Not that I blame him. That was a tall order that Moses had. We go to verses 16 and 17 of Exodus 33. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, and I and your people? Is it not by your going with us, so that we, I and your people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are upon the face of the earth? The Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing of which you have spoken. For you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by my name. He's repeating that, repeating the fact that Moses had found favor in God's sight and that God had known Moses by his name. Again, the burning bush and the Shekinah glory cloud, in the Shekinah glory cloud at the top of Mount Sinai. And so God says, okay, you found favor with me. I'll let you be the leader. I'll be in the midst of the people and help you as you lead the people out. Now Moses says, how can it be known that I found favor in your sight? It was probably known before because of the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day, which God's going to take away. He's threatening to take away here. And Moses is saying, look, everybody's seeing that pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. They see that. So they know that you're leading us and that I am the leader of Israel and that I have found favor in your sight. And they know that you leave, the people going to leave me. That's the way the argument's running here. Moses is begging for the presence of God. You know, there's in the more mystically or pietistically or spiritually inclined writers in the Christian faith, you hear this term presence a lot. Like, what was that book by Brother Lawrence called Practicing the Presence of God? And I always used to think that's a little bit spooky, and not spooky, but just a little bit super spiritual or something. No, it's not. Moses, that's what Moses was looking for. He was looking for the presence of God in the midst of the people. And he was looking for a physical manifestation of it. And he's not finished yet, because we go to 18, 19, and 20. We read this, Exodus 33. Then Moses said, I pray you, Moses is saying, I, Moses, pray to you, Yahweh, show me your glory. And he, Yahweh, said, I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But he, that's Yahweh, said, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. Now, the first question I have is, why is Moses still praying to God? I mean, God's already promised him everything he wanted. I'll be with you, Moses. I'll be in the midst of the people. Well, Moses must have, at this point, realized that God was doing something special with the Israelites. Because just previously, Moses thought that God might wipe them out. And now he's saying, oh my goodness, God is still going to be with us? Oh my goodness. What kind of a glorious God would forgive this golden calf incident? Maybe Moses needed confidence after being shook up by the golden calf incident. And so he's saying, please, God, show me some of your glory. The people are so wicked and sinful and it seems to me that you really ought to kill them for all. In fact, you've already killed 3,000 of them, maybe kill the rest of them for what they've done. And I just don't know if I can carry these people through the desert, even though you've promised to be with me. So I need some more help. I need some more affirmation. I need some more credibility in the eyes of the people. How about show me some more glory? I'm not sure if that's reading Moses' psychology right, but I'll tell you what. Moses asked to see the glory of God, and I don't see anything wrong with Christians doing that either. The NIV Study Bible says that, quote, in a sense, Moses' prayer was finally answered on the Mount of Transfiguration, where he shared a vision, however brief, of the Lord's glory with Elijah and three of Jesus' disciples. Let's look at that. Luke 9, 30 through 32, Mount of Transfiguration. And behold, two men were talking with him, with Jesus, and they were Moses and Elijah. So Moses is on the mount now, after he's already died and gone to heaven. He comes back on the Mount of Transfiguration. And Moses and Elijah, appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. In other words, Jesus' crucifixion. Verse 32, now Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, but when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. So Moses saw the glory of God when he saw the glory of Jesus. Now, of course, Jesus is God incarnate. God's full glory was veiled by the flesh of Jesus. And so you can look at Jesus without getting killed. We need to look at verse 20 here in Exodus 33. God says, tells to Moses, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. When you're looking at somebody in the face, you get the full force of their glory, if you will. You can't look God full on in the face and see God's glory and survive it. You just can't. I give you some examples. Jacob wrestling with the angel at Peniel on the river Jabbok, coming back from Syria, Genesis 32:30. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God's face. I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Peniel means face of God. So Jacob saw God face to face, yet my life has been preserved, because he figured that generally you see God face to face, you're fried. But of course, now remember, Jacob saw the angel of Jehovah. He saw a theophany. He saw God veiled in incarnate flesh, Jesus. And so he didn't really see God face to face. He said he did, but he didn't really. Because if he had seen God face to face, he would have been scorched. John 1:18 says, no one has ever seen God. God is a spirit. You have to see his son. But at any rate, Moses asked to see God's glory, and God graciously acknowledges the request, but he said, I'm going to have to tell you something. You're not going to see me in my full glory, because if you do that, you're going to die, and you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. So what he's going to do is let my goodness pass before you, Moses. I'm going to let my goodness pass before you. So what was this glory? What was this goodness that was going to pass before Moses? Ellicott, the commentator, says it's not clear how God fulfilled this. The NIV Study Bible says the goodness that passed before Moses would include God's mercy, grace, and compassion, which is sort of an indirect conveyance of God's glory to Moses. I'm not really sure that that's what it is. John Gill says the goodness that's going to pass before Moses is the same as God's glory. And I tend to think that's right. This was fulfilled, by the way, in the next chapter, chapter 34, verses 6 through 7. So let's go ahead and read that. The Lord passed in front of him, in front of Moses, and proclaimed, the Lord is a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in faithful love and truth, maintaining faithful love to 1,000 generations, forgiving iniquity, rebellion, and sin. But he will not leave the guilty unpunished, bringing the father's iniquity on the children and the grandchildren to the third and fourth generation. This, of course, is when God held Moses in a cleft of a rock, passed by him, so that Moses wouldn't look at God face to face and get toasted. Now, Ellicott comments on this meeting of Moses with God in Exodus 34, which is the answer to Moses' request in Exodus 33. This is what Ellicott says, quote, a revelation of God's ineffable goodness was miraculously flashed into his inmost soul, and the 1,000 instances of it which he had known brought distinctly to his recollection so as to pass before him. That's some highfalutin language. I just wonder whether it was just a bright light that he saw. I don't know. It's interesting that in the fulfillment of this request to see God's glory, God says, the Lord is a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in faithful love and truth, maintaining faithful love to 1,000 generations, forgiving iniquity, rebellion, and sin. With this idea of forgiveness, we see back in Exodus 33, our current chapter, where God says, in answer to Moses' request to see God's glory, God says, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and show compassion on whom I will show compassion. Why would God say that right in the context of a request to see his glory? Well, I think what God is doing here, he's saying, look, I can forgive whoever I want. You want to see my glory? Well, I tell you, I've already done something glorious. I've forgiven the people for the golden calf idolatry. I can forgive them if I want to. I don't have to, but if I want to, I can. I can forgive them, and then I can show you my glory and give you some good news after all the bad news. So I think that God is trying to emphasize his mercy, his forgiveness, and especially when we go to verse chapter 34 and see the fulfillment of this, God goes on and on about how he's faithful and loving and forgiving iniquity and rebellion and so forth. But now, and I'll talk about this when I get to chapter 34, but notice that in Exodus 34 verses 6 and 7, God says, the Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. After he's just finished talking about how he forgives iniquity, he forgives rebellion, he forgives sin, he maintains faithful love for thousands of generations and slow to anger, he's gracious, he's compassionate, and faithful, loving truth and all that. But he's not going to leave the guilty unpunished. That sounds like a direct contradiction to me. Well, to reconcile that, this is the way I reconcile it, is, yeah, God chooses to forgive, but that he doesn't choose to forgive everybody. He chooses to forgive his elect. Some are forgiven, but some are punished. Even though everybody deserved punished, he decided to forgive some of them, not all of them. Otherwise, you got a contradiction there, don't you? Or it's an apparent contradiction, unless there's a different way to reconcile it that I haven't thought about before. Now, this request for glory, it couldn't have been what Moses saw at the top of Mount Sinai. At least John Gill says so, because Moses wouldn't be asking to see it again. But I object to that. I say, why not? It might have been such a wonderful sight to see God on top of Mount Sinai. I might want to see him again. I don't think Gill's reasoning is strong there. Gill says this glory was some visible, glorious representation of God. I think so. It's like bright Shekinah glory, light. Gill says it might have been that Moses wanted to see the Messiah. Well, I don't know. How does he know who the Messiah is at this point? I think that's a stretch. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say of this, quote, "This is one of the most mysterious scenes described in the Bible. He had, for his comfort and encouragement, a splendid and full display of the divine majesty, not in its unveiled effulgence, but as far as the weakness of humanity would admit." I love that phrase, unveiled effulgence. Effulgence just means bright, radiant glory. It's a great word. Nobody ever uses it, but I like it, effulgence. Ellicott says of this request to see God's glory, quote, "All that he had yet seen of God, Moses had seen of God, was insufficient, only raised his desire, only sharpened his appetite to see more. He craved for that beatific vision which is the final reward of them that are perfected in another world." Oh, I love it. We go now to Exodus 33, verses 21 through 23. "Then the Lord said, Behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will come about, while my glory is passing by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." Now, this again is going to be fulfilled in the next chapter. This is God telling Moses in advance what he's about to do. Now, we've got God standing here. Well, Moses is standing there. And then God is going to use his hand, his back, and his face. He's going to let Moses see his back. And then God's going to take his hand away from Moses. And then he tells Moses, you're not going to see my face. Well, folks, God does not have hands. He doesn't have a back. And he doesn't have a face. So all through this section, God is speaking anthropomorphically, or to say it more easily, in the matter of men, as the NIV Study Bible puts it. As I said earlier, this is fulfilled in the next chapter, at Exodus 34, verse 5. "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called on the name of the Lord. Then the Lord passed by in front of him," and so forth. Now, why did God say that Moses was going to see his back when God doesn't have a back? Because this was symbolic of the fact that Moses was not seeing God in his full glory. Because if he had done that, Moses would have died. So Moses got to see, as the King James put it, God's hindward parts, or something crazy like that, is back. Ladies and gentlemen, I have now finished Genesis chapter 33, Moses and Yahweh at the tent of meeting. This prepares us for chapter 34, our next audio, in which I will discuss Moses making the new tablets and renewing the covenant with Israel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.